We basically live in a circumstance in this country where we're told that we don't have power in public space. And that's a crazy paradox, because literally for thousands of years, in my case before the Celts were conquered by the Romans, we all believed that we had the power to do something in the space between our homes. In fact, the space between our homes was a commons that we all had access to and we could celebrate in and create within. Like if we needed a bench for an elder to sit on, you know, we would just create that in the morning with some kids, and then they would learn about civic responsibility and stuff like that. In an American neighborhood, you're told that you have no power out there between your homes. And that's basically, to me, that's violence against our identity as we experienced it for hundreds of thousands of years. And to tell us that we don't have the power to create in that space creates a disassociative effect and a lack of dynamism.
Welcome to the Regenerative Real Estate Podcast, a show about human environments and how they can be used as a force for good. Conversations that educate and inspire people looking for a different way to do real estate. I'm Neil Collins, and on this episode, I'm joined by architect, placemaker, and urban planner Mark Lakeman of Communitecture and other organizations including the City Repair Project and the Village Building Convergence. Some of you may know this, but before moving to the Puget Sound region, my partner Alyssa and I called Portland, Oregon home for close to a decade. I remember the first time that I came upon an intersection in a neighborhood painted as a gigantic sunflower with vibrant yellows, oranges, and reds. Now, I'm a sucker for building murals, so it was really something to see this painted on the street. I took a picture and wrote down where it was located so I wouldn't forget where it was. But what was even more unsuspecting was that a day later, I found yet another intersection in another neighborhood painted as an underwater scene with a large blue whale right in the center. And then I found another one painted with geometric shapes in another neighborhood. And it went on like that for years. We are constantly discovering new murals painted in the middle of an intersection. Now, there's other things about Portland, too, that I found utterly charming and unique. You see, it's hard to go more than a block or two in those neighborhoods without finding a little free library in someone's front yard. Somewhere else, there's a tree with branches overhanging a sidewalk where people have written down their wishes to dangle from the branches. A bus stop might be converted into a Cobb art structure with a mermaid's tail forming a bench. And in another neighborhood, there's a 24-hour tea station with hot water and tea bags for neighbors passing by. And the list truly does go on. It wasn't until years later, when I was attending what is called a village building convergence, that I learned that many of these placemaking initiatives could be traced back to one man, and that's Mark Lakeman. For those of you unfamiliar with Mark, you're in for a real treat. He is the principal and design director of the community architecture and planning firm Communitecture. He is also the founder of the nonprofit placemaking movement and organization known as the City Repair Project. As per his bio, he is an urban placemaker and permaculture designer, community design facilitator, and an inspiring catalyst in his very active commitment to the emergence of sustainable cultural landscapes everywhere. Every design project he is involved with furthers the development of a beneficial vision for human and ecological communities, whether this involves urban design and placemaking, permaculture and ecological communities, or ecological building, encouragement of community interaction, or assisting those typically that do not have access to design services. Mark's leadership has benefited communities across the North American continent. Before we get in the show, I want to give a shout out to a real national treasure that we get the honor of working closely with, and that is another Mark. This time, our partner at Latitude, Mark Voss, who calls Madison, Wisconsin home. Mark has been a biodynamic urban farmer and teacher for decades before jumping into the real estate industry as a change agent, where he sees the potential to use real estate as a catalyst for healing and regeneration. You can check out his work through Latitude's website or visiting his social media channels at Voss Organics and at Voss Region Realty. And I also want to begin sharing more about some really cool features that we have at Latitude that I don't think I've talked about on this show, particularly what we call our ecosystem directory. This directory can be found at our website at choose latitude.com/ecosystem-directory. And it's like our Rolodex that has companies and organizations that are all purpose aligned for this kind of work to bring regenerative projects into life. This directory is our way of helping people like yourself more easily find the resources that you need in order to create healthy, resilient, and beautiful habitats in your own community. And on this episode, I want to give a shout out to our ecosystem directory partner, EcoNest Architecture. The principal architect there is named Paula Baker Lepore, who was an early podcast guest of ours on this show. Paula recently published a book called Prescriptions for a Healthy House that has incredible tips to create a healthy home for you and your family. We recently got the chance to visit Paula at her own home that is an eco-nest based on Vedic design principles and built out of natural materials. And I've got to tell you, it is truly stunning and next level. You can check out more of her work at econestarchitects.com. Now, without further ado, let's get into the conversation with Mark Lakeman. Well, Mark, I've been really looking forward to this conversation. I've actually had the pleasure of tuning into different talks that you've given, but also have lived in Portland that I know has been shaped by you in a lot of different ways, from like the really subtle things to like really concerted efforts. And I know that you've got a history that you grew up almost in a family that was like destined to create somebody within the built environment and placemaking, with your mom being an architect and your dad also, was he an urban planner? Is that right?
Architect and urban planner, yeah.
And I love to really go back to understand like how people have formed their life philosophies. And I'd love to dive in there, what that was like to have lived with two creative professionals really steeped in placemaking.
Okay, sure. I love starting with them because I think it's really important for people to credit people that whose shoulders they stand on. I've always had a problem with like individuating authorship because I feel like so much of what we do is cumulative. We're most effective when we honor where we come from and who our mentors have been, and then kind of standing in a humble place, we have more, you know, creative capacity. So yeah, crediting my parents is a great start. My mom's kind of this, at this point, kind of a grandmother version of Indiana Jones. And for the last couple decades has been crawling around in caves and all kinds of unusual ancient architecture, mostly investigating the interrelatedness of public and private space and how villages have emerged and kind of evolved over time. And not just kind of village public spaces, but kind of all the expressions of culture that are designed and the values they express. Like, you know, for instance, what she's really curious about is, what does it look like when power is concentrated? What does public space look like when a few people are making decisions? Versus a whole community that's making decisions for themselves. And then what do all of the different cultural expressions, like how are we buried? What do the places look like and how do they function? What's so interesting for her about the island of Sardinia is that there's almost no evidence of concentrated power. And so the production of all that they created is the spectrum of all these incredible archetypes of designed spaces are limitless and just everywhere because they weren't repressed and controlled. And they were essentially a collaborative culture. So I benefit from her grabbing me by the ear and dragging me around the world so that I can sort of see these different examples, all these alternative realities, essentially, that contribute to the human story. That's expanded my imagination and my access, my creative access to possibilities. Because I'm not, when I'm standing in this reality that we find ourselves in, you know, basically westward expansion and manifest destiny here in Western USA, the big colonial grid that most people live in, but scarcely see or understand right before their eyes. When I look at it, I have a very strong sense of how it's here, why it's here, what it does to us, and what we can do about it. So she studies how villages are basically expressions of how human beings problem solve and adapt their lives, basically meeting their own needs and solving their own problems takes the form of villages over and over again that aren't just shelter, but they're receivers of light and they're deflectors of wind and they adapt to the landscape and they capture the water and they result in cultural spaces and songs and stories and families that, you know, evolve over time. So I've learned from her that basically how culture has evolved is through problem solving and then turning that into joy, into song and story and art and space and place. So that's my mom. My dad, both my mom and my dad come from Southern Ohio, where they emerged in the late 50s and early 60s, infused with all this, like, you know, the spirit of the time. They took John F. Kennedy very seriously when, you know, he was like, you know, ask not what, you know, your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. So this call to service. And for them both going into architecture school, they were thinking that design was a means to create a better world. So my dad's story is that he's this completely irrepressible farm boy from Southern Ohio who wanted to just break free of the cultural stasis of that place and go westward with his little family to give us a chance to grow up in a more open-minded society. And then surrounded by all the Cascade Mountains and the amazing salmon streams everywhere. So he wanted to be here, but also he was hired to change Portland. He was hired to found the function of urban design in the city government. So his fingerprints are all over our signature public spaces of Waterfront Park and Pioneer Square and Markham Nature Park, Pearl District, the South Waterfront, like basically all of the foundational planning for revolutionizing what was just industrial space and turning it into, you know, a new urban fabric was those foundations. And then the actualizing a lot of it was the work of the 60s and 70s into the 80s. So I got to grow up, like, basically my bedtime stories were my dad coming home at the end of the day and I'm waiting for the sound of his car coming up the gravel drive. I'd wait for him to come home and tell me the latest installment. And one of my favorite stories is him coming home and saying, well, we might lose my job tomorrow. We're going to end up living in a tent again. And that's okay because, you know, you have to lay it all out there to make the world a better place. You can't be afraid. So the mayor's maybe going to fire me. And I was like, yay, I love living in a tent. That's been a lot of our life so far. I love camping with my dad and my mom. But he didn't get fired and the square was created. Like he was going around all over the city, getting people to oppose the mayor and almost half the city council. Who were trying to stop the public square from happening. Because as Mayor Ivinsky said at the time, if I let you create the public square, then people will gather. So, you know, one of the things that people need to understand, and I'm really clear about because I grew up in these dynamics, is that public space, the existence of it, the administration of it, the access to it, but the existence of it, whether or not it even exists, is a political issue. Like, we live in a country where we talk about freedom of assembly and freedom of expression, and yet we have the fewest community gathering places of all first world nations. Like almost no neighborhood across the entire country, except for the Eastern Seaboard, has a village center or a public square at all. You know, there are a few outstanding examples, because they tend to predate the National Land Ordinance of 1785, when the Continental Congress literally blueprinted Roman colonialism and then used that as the framework for westward expansion. The Romans weren't interested in building community. They were interested in organizing conquered territories and isolating people within a regimented structure so that they would just work all the time and not have any ideas that would counter the impulse to expand and control and divide and conquer. So, you know, Portland, Oregon has 95 neighborhoods and not a single public square in any of them, just as it's true almost entirely of Seattle and San Diego and Chicago. Every one of us live in this massive, monotonous, relentless Roman grid that was violently laid down over the villages of thousands of years of indigenous patterns that preexisted. And that erasure is intentional. So I'm basically joining my mom and dad's histories together. And I would just summarize it by saying I'm their Frankenstein child. Like, they created me to go forward with a pencil and a triangle drawing instruments and carry on the work. So the work I've been doing since I was really a little kid, and then through college and now in my profession, has been to try to use design as a means to make the world a better place.
A funny anecdote about this, the grid. I was going through the Portland State University Masters of Commercial Real Estate Development, and I had a professor that was like really extolling the benefits of the grid system. And then maybe like 3 days later, I was part of the Village Building Convergence and listening to you talk about the grid and westward expansion. And it was such an interesting juxtaposition of perspectives. And you realize like this is the industry that we're in of around design and development. And like some people saying this is amazing because we can move people around. And this is how transference of land works so easily and efficiently. But then from the design perspective that you really brought up, it was like, wow, this is a completely different narrative that we're not even hearing in academic discourse.
Yeah, we're basically in a context where it kind of has its own value system and logic, and people are trying to make lives within that system. But yeah, the grid works very well and to facilitate the commodification of the land and really of everything. You might have heard me say at the Village Building Convergence that the grid is really about commodifying time, space, and reality. And that to understand how empire works and how expansionist cultures work to invade and then conquer other people and then organize conquered territories, you have to understand kind of the essential design of the colonial infrastructure, really, in order for it to be controllable from a remote place so that a few people can be organizing and controlling it, commodification of it, and not only of the land, but of people's time and of their resources as this interchangeable field of exchange, that set of dynamics serves the goals and aspirations of colonial expansion. And I don't want to curse anybody working in real estate development, just as I'm, as an architect, I don't want to curse people that are sitting there whose jobs depend upon all of those dynamics, because here we are, we're in it. And at the same time, we contribute to driving up the cost of living and really the outcomes that people call gentrification. And we have to understand that in order to humanize it, I think. So yeah, the grid works very well for real estate. It makes things comparable, and comparables are really a vital dimension of how people assign value to things that are sold as part of the real estate culture. So no doubt it works very well. And we have to understand it works very well to do the things it was designed to do.
To continue along this narrative from your parents into architecture, at what point did you know that you were going to do that? Because I could see you jumping off into anthropology, but I also, you know, I see a lot of architects that the site is, let's say, this 50 by 100 square. But my sense of understanding your work from an arm's length distance away is that the project is the community. And that's a really interesting leap. And I'm curious when you started to make that jump, and was that really apparent that you were going to be going into architecture through advocacy and activism, or how did it develop over time?
Yeah, okay. Gosh, I mean, thank you. Thanks for bringing me back. Yeah, how did I get where I am? Okay, so there was this heroic urge, and my dad kept saying to me that design could make a better world, and we were missing community spaces. So I was helped in my formation to be conscious of that there was a designed absence. So that opened me up. And I really thrived in things like urban studies, where I could look at, like in high school, for instance, there was an urban studies course I was able to take. And I just really went through the roof on that, because I'm a generalist with lots of skills of specialists in me. Like I love doing all kinds of things, from hands-on things to big macro scale visioning. I love to implement things. I love to work with children. I love to work with elders. I love to design whole villages, and I could install all the plumbing and electrical myself, because I'm just passionate about all those things. I have lots and lots of energy. So I got a big skill set basically, and a lot of curiosity. So that was really helpful. I'm constantly integrating new information. And at the same time, I'm very relativistic. So I don't really fix on one philosophy. I keep learning and learning. And then for instance, one of the programs that I've instituted in the City Repair Project nonprofit has been this set of policies Portland has adopted that make it so that every neighborhood can transform street intersections into public squares. And now the streets that connect the intersections are now available for communities to recreate. All the streets and all the neighborhoods are available, all the intersections and all the neighborhoods. And there's lots of things that you can do on your own authority that are automatically permitted and insured. So in order to get there to that, I had to kind of come up with an understanding, a set of goals. But in order to form that, I couldn't do that in a vacuum, no matter how much my parents had helped me, and no matter how much my own corporate immersion in like big firms in downtown Portland kind of helped me. They helped me to have the chops to design big things, but they also helped me to know how I didn't want to operate in the field of design, and how I didn't want to interact with other people that I was working with. This is very top down, very kind of propelled just by a profit motive and not really cultural objectives. In fact, it's very famous that architects have to trick developers and real estate agents through using a language to say like, oh, well, you'll make more money if you make a more interesting and wonderful place with natural light, because then firms will want to stay there longer and you won't have as much turnover. And like, that's all true, but the architect's actually trying to do something interesting and wonderful in the world and not just something reductionist. So there's a bit of an antagonism in the culture that ought to be more collaborative. Anyway, I was learning all that stuff, coming through all that mess. I lasted about 3 years at these big firms before we were working on the Bank of America building on the west side of the Morrison Bridge. And there was a huge toxic waste cover-up under that building. And I was so angry at how everyone was laughing about it. The contractor was laughing about paying off the government inspectors that we had just been in this big meeting. And I was so upset. I was like, okay, this is not the culture I can identify with. So I quit. Part of my story of coming through to becoming who I am is that I quit that day, and I literally went from there to traveling 7 years to visit villages all over the world. And part of that was spending time with my mom, visiting those villages. And I was doing a lot of documentation for her books. She was writing books. So I was measuring villages and doing proportional relationship drawings of heights and widths of public spaces and visiting tombs. So this was a fantastic time of growth. But after 7 years, I came back and I was filled with ideas, because every one of these villages, I was engaging on a social level. So I was making friends and I was listening to them talk about America. And I kept asking people, what do you think is, what can you see? What can you tell me that we need to do? And they were like, okay, first of all, you don't even realize you live in this giant colonial infrastructure. The most mind-blowing experiences were visiting indigenous people in different circumstances, different cultures, and listening to them and also just being there to watch what people are like. Like my favorite one is this is Mayan village in Chiapas in the Selva Lacandona, the Lacandon rainforest. I went to visit this village for a series of extended periods. And I'm in a place where nobody has to ever get a building permit. They never have to seek funding for anything they're doing. There's no public presentations except, you know, in the village center, they have these great meetings where everyone gets to talk and hear each other. People are always doing things. They're always being productive. But it's, I would say essentially, if you boil down their economy, it's to wake up in the morning and figure out how to engage their children and mentor them in the next thing that they're doing as a village. And there's this whole phenological calendar where their lives are in this kind of groove with the cycles of nature. And so I'm getting there to be in that. And there's literally no crime and the public health. Well, how would you even measure it? There's so few indicators of distress. No property lines. Everything's a commons. And yet everyone distinctly lives within kind of a cradle of their own responsibility. Everything about that society was different, from the way that they engaged the divine, the rituals that they had, to how they grew food, like regenerative cycles, basically of permaculture, perpetually in thin rainforest soil, which you're not supposed to be able to do. So I came away from there completely in culture shock and came back here. And, you know, that was the end of me asking questions. That was the final culture that I visited. And I gathered enough. But before I came home, I had so many different conversations. And one of them was this person saying to me, you know, well, if you really want to understand the grid, you have to understand who your people used to be before you came into contact with the violence of those long, straight, flat lines that divide the world into separate pieces. So I was listening really intently. And he said, if you really want to understand it, you need to know your own story. So who were your people before they came into contact with those lines? And of course, my ancestry is Celtic. And the violent invasion of what are now the British Islands, and it was a horrific, repressive invasion in which our language and our, you know, basically so much about our culture was outlawed. Women were reduced from this status of basically equality to a subclass, you know, that we're still dealing with today. So I was advised to go home and stand in my own neighborhood and look at these flat lines and see how they extended in all directions and walk a little way and see that it was everywhere and go to another city and see that it was everywhere. And in fact, that is the case. And there's not a single gathering place in my entire community. So I finally got to see that the consequence of what a great urban theorist from the 60s named Sybil Moholy Nagy, she wrote the book, The Matrix of Man, which is the only comprehensive account of the colonial grid that I've ever come upon. She calls it totalitarian design, the idea that a few people can lay out the entire fabric of where other people will live. And those few people can decide whether or not any shred of cultural infrastructure will be included in the plan. You know, people like Eli Spivak, who I work with as a developer in Portland all the time, every project that we've done together includes more and more infrastructure. And now he's trying to address climate change by putting in live workspaces so people don't have to commute. He's trying to make it as integral as possible with play spaces and, you know, gardens and perennial growing systems, pollinator habitats. So he's integrating all the time. He's a great developer. He's a beloved developer. People love him. He's leaving a legacy of a better world wherever he can. And on the other hand, looking at the historical landscape that we've inherited, you know, like Selwood, everybody loves Selwood and thinks it's a great neighborhood. At the same time, not a single public square, like no kind of infrastructure of urban agriculture, just really vast tracts of housing with Main Street commercial corridors, which is typical across the country. And yet it's lovely because, you know, we're doing a great job of retrofitting it with lots and lots of trees and lots of native gardens and lots of individual agriculture. So we're doing lots of great things there. But the configuration across the whole country, and really it's true of almost all of North America, is that a few people design the reality that other people live in, toil in, with the fewest places for them to talk and even meet others. of all nations. And it's because of how it's been designed. It's been developed for profit without consideration, even for spaces where people would meet others. And so we have the most intense consequence in terms of social isolation of all, you know, kind of expansionist countries in the world, like vast open spaces. And it's true of the whole of the Western Hemisphere, of places like Australia, you know, everywhere where somebody comes and sets up a whole new system. But it's most intense for us.
I feel like this is the conversation that people started to tune into because of the pandemic, but hadn't really been talking about the pandemic of isolation or epidemic of isolation before that. But I'm in this book right now called Urban Alchemy that is written from the perspective of what happened with urban renewal programs in African American communities and just getting ripped apart by these policies and really having this longing grief for what home is. And it had to be, and doctors just prescribed it as nostalgia, this like loss of home. And I think a lot of people right now are recognizing that there's something broken within their spaces. And that takes real courage, I think, to just recognize we need to revitalize, we need to regenerate. But what do you think? What are the patterns that we can start to grasp onto to initiate the coming together to rebuild the village and to integrate community?
Yeah, this is so exciting to talk about. The fact that I'd say I'm going to talk about these wonderful design patterns that can be retrofit and give a little bit of background to them. I'm so excited that I've just had a meeting with Safer Blocks in Portland. They're kind of a PBOT-funded organization with a few million dollars to spend in the next year. And I think one of the ways that money's going to be spent is in the answer to your question, with Portland as a big petri dish to show the rest of the nation how to do this. It's so exciting. So, for instance, let's talk about Brentwood Darlington in Portland, Oregon, as an example. So here's a neighborhood. It's basically a rectangle. It's got maybe a couple of streets coming in. It's just basically the grid. There's nothing that descends. There's no forest. There's no stream. So we had a workshop there in Brentwood, Darlington one time years ago. And we presented the placemaking patterns that were distilled by Kevin Lynch in his travels. He's basically an academic. And he wrote this wonderful book called The Image of the City. I think it's a little dense to get through, so I'm just going to present a bulleted list here. And this is actually a modified version of Kevin's list. But Kevin's list is basically the outstanding design patterns that characterize the most economically and culturally, artistically robust villages in the world. So if you go traveling around the world and you find a village that's just very attractive, you'll tend to find these characteristics, these recurring patterns. They're not details, they're patterns. So here they are. The most memorable villages, the ones that kind of are indelible in your mind, will tend to have some sort of discernible way that they begin and end. And obviously that would be true of a medieval village that's set up to be defensive with some kind of castle wall. And that's beautiful to us now. Back then, of course, it would connote, you know, like, oh, whoa, they're defending themselves against something intense. But there are villages that don't have distinct castle walls. They also just have really smart edges where farmland begins and ends, and they manage to stay within their boundaries. So it doesn't have to be a defensive wall, but so boundary or precinct edge, whatever you want to call it. And then when you approach the form, which is just, it's a beautiful form. I think of San Gimignano in Italy with all of these towers coming up. The towers are lovely to us now, but back when they were created, they were for shooting arrows at each other between families. Okay. So something about the form is lovely to us. We love looking at the sunset through those towers. So the form, the overall form, that's number one. Number two is as you approach it, it's not just a perfunctory portal for coming in. It's something that welcomes you. Like the best villages make a big deal out of the fact that you've arrived. They're like, sculptural, some glorious arch, some bougainvillea dangling over, some memorial fountains, some kind of artistic expression. Think of the Lion's Gate at Mykene in Greece, the palace of the great king, Agamemnon. So like they really celebrated that, like this place is a big deal. So portals, you could call them gateways or portals. Then when you enter, this is a tough one for an American, but the pathways themselves are a design element. So rather than thinking that they're just a way to access from A to B, as an American would think, like, how do I get from where I am to where I'm going? The pathways themselves are an experience. So they're a journey in themselves. And this is why we travel across the ocean to visit Siena. The pathways rise and fall with the topography. So they're a lovely walkable journey. The entire village is infused with a sense of place. The whole thing is a story that you move through. So that's the third element, is the path. The fourth element is probably the village center, or the great piazza, or the great Platz. If you're in Germany or in France, it would be the Platz. You know, every culture really has a word for the village center or the village heart. So in Siena, of course, everyone wants to get to the Piazza del Campo, which is where it's this great kind of cradle that faces the sun and has a great tower that's a sundial that sweeps across, the shadow sweeps across the surface of the piazza every day. So everybody goes to see that. And that's where they have the great cultural festivals and stuff, the great horse race of the Palio of Siena. So that element is this distinct commons where everyone in the entire village can fit, and they all feel like that they all belong to it and it belongs to them. So it's this great uniting presence. Every neighborhood in the whole country needs this. And then the next element, the fifth element, would be all these nodes of other kinds of activities. Like, for instance, in Siena, they have multiple contrada. These are neighborhoods, but it's the Italian word, the Sienese word for the subsection of the village. Each contrada has multiple piazzas. And then around those piazzas are the cafes and bookshops and flower shops and stuff that vitalize the edges of all of these subspaces. And then there's usually a museum in each contrada that tells the story of that part of the village. So that's not the final element, though. The final one is the most ubiquitous. It can happen everywhere, anytime, and it can be permanent and it can be ephemeral. And these are places of memory. Kevin Lynch called them monuments, but basically they're things that punctuate the landscape. So you could be walking along and it could be a fountain, a sculpture, a plaque, you know, in a kind of a more conservative environment, that's what it would look like. But in, you know, a USA neighborhood, it could be some, you know, installation. It could be some goofy thing. Like, I like to hang poetry from trees. I like to hang ribbons from trees. I like to get together with kids and stamp with big giant sponges dinosaur prints on a sidewalk that connects the houses of a couple of first grade best friends to each other. I like to do that with kids. And that's kind of like the effect of the place of memory, the monument. You're punctuating it with some expression of love or information. It's a wide spectrum. But those are six elements, and every neighborhood can feature those things. And they don't if you continue to believe, as an American citizen, that you don't have the power to do it. I want to belabor this point a little bit. We basically live in a circumstance in this country where we're told that we don't have power in public space. And that's a crazy paradox, because literally for thousands of years, in my case, before the Celts were conquered by the Romans, we all believed that we had the power to do something in the space between our homes. In fact, the space between our homes was a commons that we all had access to and we could celebrate in and create within. Like, if we needed a bench for an elder to sit on, you know, we would just create that in the morning with some kids, and then they would learn about civic responsibility and stuff like that. In an American neighborhood, you're told that you have no power out there between your homes. And that's basically to me, that's violence against our identity as we experienced it for hundreds of thousands of years. And to tell us that we don't have the power to create in that space creates a disassociative effect and a lack of dynamism that disengages children and makes them kind of wander without understanding that their agency can be focused in constructive ways right where they live to make their neighborhood a better place. So I'm just peeling the lid off of a whole bunch of issues right there. But basically, in order to retrofit an American neighborhood with that fabric of place, we have to exercise our voices and assume our creative power And the last thing I'll say in that little rant there is that for people to realize that they're actually not alone, neighborhood by neighborhood, everyone is surrounded by the full spectrum of all the skills and talents that they need as a village to recreate the place where they live. But because of the function of, like you mentioned, real estate culture, part of what we're dealing with in design and development real estate culture are things like zoning structures that cause a disassociative effect. Like here we are, we all live together, but because of the design of the city, we all have to leave each other at the start of the day and all go elsewhere away from where we live to earn the currency to then pay for where we barely get to be back where we supposedly live. And that design is a designed sort of deconstruction of the village. So to say, oh, we're going to meet the challenge of climate change while we make our children healthier, while we try to become a more resilient, interconnected society, it means you have to be able to live and work in the same place. So at the end of the day, you don't just have currency, but you have stronger, deeper relationships with the people that you're living and working with. Those are that is probably the most essential pattern of all the villages that I've visited in my life. They have the power to live and work together, and they have power of place. So they can solve their own problems. They're basically their own government, police force, fire department, you know, their own mentors for their own kids. They teach their kids. They model for their kids. Anyway, I'm summarizing a whole lot right there.
I love it. And I don't want to even pick some of these things up that I had jotted down. If we should go deeper on this. I'm really curious, because we're now looking at an arc, even a multi-generational arc of creating place that has been written up and modeled with so many different cities around North America. What are some seeds that you might have planted a while ago that have come to fruition that you're really proud of or are still paying attention to of trying to encourage them to come forth?
Thanks. Well, this is where we actually help the listeners understand how this all takes shape. So back in 1996, I got together with these kids in my neighborhood back when we were doing the first transformation of a street intersection into a public square. And this was the model that inspired our city council to unanimously legalize this kind of project. And when I say legalize, not just adopt the policy, but to actually retroactively legalize something that we had done that wasn't legal. Well, on the southeast corner of that intersection was the first little free library in the world, officially. So these two little kids on the corner, they were neglected foster kids. You could hear them sometimes being yelled at by their foster parents. And nobody was really spending time with them. I knew that. So I got together with these kids. And all that traveling I had done had taught me, I'd learned the joy of being facilitative, like a dad gets to be. I got to be like a dad before I actually had a little daughter, which I have now. So with these kids, I was asking them, with a lot of foreknowledge about villages, I was asking these kids what they wanted to do. I asked the foster parents if I could spend the afternoon with them and teach them how to use some tools. Pretty sure that they had never had anyone help them with that. So the girl Siobhan and the boy Timmy both talked about loving books. So I said, okay, well, how about if we make a place for books? We're very excited to do that. And we're like, where are we going to get the materials? So the Socratic method, like the kids turned to this demolition site where a house was being torn down. And we walked over to the site. We pulled out an old window and some boards. We pulled out the nails. They got to learn how to pull nails and drive some nails, use a screwdriver. And we even salvaged some hinges. And the first little free library in the world began that way, that day, through the inspiration of these two kids and their reskilling, kind of little educational exercise there. And that was 1996. So around 2009 or 2013, something like that, the little free library people from Madison actually came upon the intersection, which was way more than just that library. It was all these other things, like a 24-hour self-service. We called it the self-service solar-powered tea station. So a place for tea on the southwest corner. and all these little amenities around the space, a little library, an art museum, a self-service chalk dispenser, pavilions for sitting under, a kid's playhouse wrapped around a tree, all these features on the corners. And this was legal now. This was our, you know, initially illegal installation, and the city council loved it so much that they legalized it. The Little Free Library came along, the founders, and saw this thing, and they thought, well, we have the prototype, so they could replicate it and make it into something that people could just purchase. And really, they would help it to expand rapidly. Quite honestly, I always expected it to somehow travel all over the place. And they really have done that job beautifully. But yeah, so that's one of the earliest innovations. And the reason that came about was, A, we were trying to do something that was endlessly replicable, and it made an ecological statement. And for me, I'm always looking at ways to get lots of things to happen out of even small gestures. So the beauty of a Little Free Library is you can get kids involved. We can put it in public space. It calls the question of whether public space is just for cars, or is it also for people. And then when you're using recycled and natural materials, you can be making an ecological design statement. And of course, you're saying something about the value of learning and education, the letters. So all of that was placemaking. And I think we've contributed powerfully to the placemaking movement. And first of all, by pointing out, you know, our early struggles with the Department of Transportation were tragic and hilarious at once. But for me, as the son of my father, you know, he would come home to me and say, these bureaucrats really hate their jobs. They're having to say no all the time. They're just processing things. They don't get to be creatively engaged. I can't tell you how many times my dad has railed against the fact that all these people that are in charge of civic infrastructure don't have any background in anthropology or public health. And planners don't even have design classes in planning school. And yet they go in wanting to make the world a better place. And when we had broken the law and the city council approved what we did, transportation was so angry at us. And they're like, you know, we sat down with them and they said, you know, you've embarrassed us, gotten away with this thing. You know, why should we even be helpful to you? And my little 7-year-old self, listening to my dad, had an answer, and it was still in there. And the answer was really sincere. And it was, you guys want to have more creative discretion in your work. You want to be able to address civic benchmarks and have a more enjoyable experience in your work, truthfully. And besides all of that, your own neighborhoods don't have a single public square either, you know, and all of which was true. And they could scarcely believe what they were hearing. I mean, I remember them almost crying. I'm quite serious. This bureaucrat was like, nobody cares about us. But, you know, let's be clear. Don't bullshit us. Nobody cares about us. But for me, I was taught to care about them because my dad was one of them. So it was true. And that's why the whole project has moved ahead, because it really is true, A, that every DOT, Department of Transportation in the country, town, city, county, state, fed, every one of them is administrating vast amounts of public space, a greater proportion than parks bureaus or national park systems. They actually are doing that. And yet they come at it from an engineering background. And you would think, well, they don't have an interest in anthropology and placemaking and sociology and urban design and all these other things that they should have an interest in. Well, they do have an interest in it, and they do love having more fun. So I can tell you, like in Portland, the last probably 4 or 5 executives in charge of the Department of Transportation here, Portland Bureau of Transportation, has been hired expressly to increase, sort of tip the balance even more toward placemaking in the public right-of-way and away from just seeing it as a traffic corridor. So our, you know, our right-of-ways are becoming verdant places that not only slow traffic, but encourage people to come outside and interact. We're actually closing lots of streets around the city in order to retrofit the city with hundreds, if not thousands, of community gathering places. So I know that we've contributed to that permanent effect. And here's the secret. We haven't been focused on the thing. We've been focused on the awareness as a culture and the values. So helping everyone get there together so they identify with why we would do this is a way of creating a lasting effect that can actually transcend the change in political landscape. You know, as leadership goes back and forth, if we can have a culture in the city, not just the bureaucracy, but the community itself, where the bureaucracy sees that it is the community and the community sees that it is the city, then we're going to be able to move forward and be increasingly resilient. Our public space needs to reflect that idea. So instead of us focusing on the physical space, we've been focusing on the cultural impact that creates the physical space. And so it's been resulting in physical spaces all over the place. Everybody wants to keep doing it.
I'm like finding myself just kind of enraptured because I'm curious about how you really facilitate that. What is the best lever that you find to help people understand the purpose and the cultural impact? Is it through facilitation? Is it through design? Or maybe it's something else?
Well, from an architectural point of view, the way that a designer would engage, in order to work in a participatory vein and make the most out of the community, you know, and result in something that the community really embraces and that is politically supported and most likely then funded and supported over time, you have to be in a facilitative mode as a designer. And that's quite counter to how we're taught to design. Like, we're really taught to think, you know, to aspire to be somebody like Frank Gehry. And to not be Frank Gehry, incidentally, to me, that is not falling short of the mark. But it is quite different than how we're taught. Like, we're taught to aspire to be iconic, like be the author of something that you literally would sign. And then everybody gets excited about the fact that they're in a Frank Gehry thing. Like, you know, we're in something that was hatched by a singular mind, a genius. Yay. But when it comes to public spaces in particular, and also village designs, it needs to be informed by a vast spectrum of intelligence and inspiration in order for it to work. And that's really by definition. And for a public space to be meaningful, because it's really a commons. So it's where people come in together. For it to really be functional and meaningful, the very genesis of it needs to be about a community story of people coming together. And, you know, I can give so much testimony about how beautifully that works. Like, we've done something like 1,000 projects now in Portland, Oregon. It's approaching 1,000 through this great barn raising process called a village building convergence. And every one of these projects that have been realized, they all start off with gatherings of people getting together in a living room, a bunch of neighbors that have never met before. And I just love this. I can't get enough of it. So, you know, I'm there as a guest. Maybe I'm going to say something to introduce the ideas, or maybe I'm just there to listen, but it's enjoyable for me no matter what. So I watch everybody walking in. And so these are people who all live within a few blocks of each other, many of whom don't know anything about each other or each other's names. Now, they're in a neighborhood where literally they've been there. That neighborhood has existed for 150 years, and it has never had the people who live there in all that time get together to do something that lasts, you know, other than a block party, perhaps, that doesn't last. But they introduce each other, they introduce themselves, and everybody gets to say, like, how long they've lived in the neighborhood and where their kids go to school or what their job is. And everything starts to warm up in a way you've never seen before. And it happens this way every time. At first, everyone's sitting there with this really tight body language, and they're like afraid. They say about Americans who are more afraid of public speaking than we are of death. And I think that's true. And I see that in every one of these gatherings. People are afraid to talk. They're unable to listen. They're so unpracticed in listening. But you do a couple go-rounds and you see these dads that are conditioned to be like, you know, like a lot of them were high school football players. So they're conditioned to like need to win or something, but their kids are in the meeting. So they're in dad mode. Most of them are like, come on, Stevie. You know, you can introduce yourself. What's your name? Come on. And the little kids have an easier time than the big kids. Anyway, it goes around. Like, where do your kids go to school? What's your job? Where do you live? Maybe it's two or three rounds. And everybody's body language is changing. They're starting to get more relaxed. As soon as they realize they're hearing stories, like somebody went to school where they went to school when they were a kid, or their children go to the same place where these people's children go, there's this cohesion that starts to gel that was always possible for 150 years and didn't get a chance to happen. So then they start getting around to like what they'd like to do. Some old lady stands up and says, I'm so tired of there not being anything around here where kids can go to play within, you know, earshot of their moms. Can't we put in some play equipment on the corner or something? And somebody said, well, what about cars? And so then they do some problem solving about that kind of contradiction. And it ends up resulting in a project that they can all take on together. And this is the coolest thing. These are all people who aren't used to sharing any money with anyone else. But as soon as you're at the village scale, then everybody wants to give a little bit, and it just takes a little bit from each person to add up to plenty. And then once you get the, I mean, you know, and everybody, every neighborhood's got people with all the tools, all the skills. You got contractors, you got people who looked after kids, you got people who make food, you got caregivers, you got everybody there. You've got all the technical knowledge and all the tools necessary to do anything they set their minds to. So they decide that they're going to do something, and they're all emotionally engaged. So they've got everything that's needed to actually get there. So one thing that we do that, you know, part of the answer to your question is we ask people to hold back from deciding how much they can spend so that that conversation happens after they get excited about what they want to do. And then you're not talking about money anymore. You're talking about every single form of capital that has been identified, you know, definitely human capital and natural capital, you know, and money is just what? Just like eight forms of capital, and money is just one of them. So in the end, it's mostly just people contributing what they have and their energy, and then needing very little in the way of money. And nobody, the accounting is totally decentralized. You don't even need to keep track because people are giving because they care. And that's how these things happen. And that's really the genesis of a village, people not having a scarcity mindset. Let me put it this way. Americans are starved for a sense of being part of a greater whole. We've been individuated since we were little kids. We've been taught that we're separate and alone. I mean, even our prevalent mythology is like, you'll be found in the book of life. There's your name. Where our judicial system, you know, individuates us and doesn't really account for the circumstances we've grown up in. You know, these retrofit strategies are really an anthropological fantasy in a way. Like I geek out personally on helping these things to happen because you get to watch the reestablishment of essential settlement patterns that found whole civilizations, but one little neighborhood subsection at a time. It's beautiful. Can't get enough of it. You know, watching dads open up and learn how to speak publicly and watching kids take their first sort of steps artistically and all the joy that gets unleashed and people really identifying with each other and feeling, I know they're feeling healing and I know they're feeling wholeness. And they can scarcely identify what they're feeling. It's just wonderful. Here's the thing. Americans move every 4 to 7 years. And the neighborhoods that have been doing this the longest, my neighborhood has been doing it the longest in Portland. People almost never move. And when somebody does move, they're usually replaced with a family that has children. So the amount of children that are engaged and out playing in the street together is extraordinary evidence of the efficacy of this work.
Then that tees up a really interesting question, and I'll give a quick context to it. I was hanging out with a group of regenerative farmers a couple of weeks ago, and for them, regeneration was soil. It was moving, grazing animals quickly over a landscape, mimicking natural herds. And I said, yeah, what about community, though? What about regenerative design? And for a lot of people, I think they hear regenerative design and they think circularity and living buildings and all this stuff. What's your take on a regenerative community, a regenerative design? Like you do ecological design, you do all these things, but I just feel like you might have a different answer than somebody like Jason McLennan.
Well, I think my answer can vary depending on what we're emphasizing in our conversation, but it does happen. I've been working on a lot of regenerative farm designs. One thing I'm excited about is that so many people that are coming in to work on these things, these initiatives, growing food and building soil, while that is one of their highest priorities, they also are coming in with a lot of other priorities that they want to integrate. For instance, my friend Patrick has an 8-acre site on the Clackamas River, and he has this kind of remnant old Christmas tree farm on his site. And all these trees kind of bolted, and then they've been thin. So they're kind of substantial, but they're very vertical. So that's becoming part of this other dimension of the farm in the form of kind of like an Ewok village of all these elevated platforms and bridges connecting them. That's part of almost like a rope course. Really, it's like a rope course. There's going to be zip lines and stuff. So he's accommodating gatherings of men on his land. This is his passion. He wants to get men on his land and have them go through kind of healing, co-counseling-like processes. So he's installing this whole program of outdoor kitchens and indoor gathering places and hearths and sacred spaces and this kind of very, this Ewok village, but it's really designed to serve people with, you know, masculine affinity, you know, to like climb things and jump on things and risk things and then sweat together and build things together and then get together and tell boy stories, you know. So he's using...
Please tell me it's called Iron John. That would be so
well, certainly, it's probably going to be required reading there at the Institute there. So that's just one example. We've probably done 12, 15 intentional farm designs, and the agricultural component isn't just about growing food. In fact, when we're working, so if you're working with us, then, you know, we're pretty well known for a kind of a social permaculture emphasis. So people are oftentimes coming and they're wanting to grow food as a means or as a curriculum. Like, there's a drawing of a village upstairs in the entry where permaculture is used as a curriculum for people that are autistic. To be able to have a way, it's kind of like, you know, autistic people are very sensitive, can't have spontaneous disruptions acoustically or visually. And yet if they have an intermediary, a thing to focus on in common, then they're able to do more things than they could have otherwise. So permaculture is becoming a language, the whole landscape that the housing for these folks are, but where they're living in their own sort of units is all nestled into a hyperabundant landscape that depends upon their interaction and their stewardship. And so we like to work on an integration of people with those systems, social systems of people, healing processes of people with the designed landscape that is productive. So we take this idea of multifunctionality to a next level. With these products
that we've been doing. This is so cool. I just got to tell you, like that, I get to interview a lot of people, and I just like really light up to hear about that. Where can people learn more about this? Like, if they're interested, drink more from this well, and really dive down into the type of work that you're doing, city repair, community texture. Like, what's the best avenues that you're like? Here it is. Here's where you can begin this journey.
Well, I think if you go to the cityrepair.org website, there's quite a lot there. And there's some galleries. And I think that you can, if you keep looking, you'll find a map that had locations of a whole lot of what we had done up to, I don't know, 2015 or something. But the map hasn't been updated, even as we've added lots and lots of projects a year. But you can find out a lot at cityrepair.org. And then at villagebuildingconvergence.com, there should be a bunch, but that site might not be updated. And that's because of the impact of the pandemic on our capacity, but we're still very much alive and have lots of wonderful people involved. You can also go to communitecture.net, and that's communitecture.net. And that's where you'll find these kind of larger projects funded, like master plans for towns and cities or neighborhoods, and then very large and small ecological projects. So communitecture.net probably has the most content and most visually stunning stuff to look at. And then if you go to, you can go to marklakeman.net, and there's a bunch of talks on there. I haven't updated that for a while, but you can see my favorite talks at the top of the list. And then you can go to YouTube and just look up either City Repair or my name, and find lots of different things on that have been recorded for more information. We have a book you can order. It's basically a placemaking guidebook, so it has a lot of really great ideas for anybody who is wanting to do this kind of work in their own community. But frankly, anybody can just email me, and I'm happy to give feedback and offer any counsel to anybody who's trying to do, you know, creative, constructive things in their neighborhood.
Mark, are you working across the country, or are you pretty Pacific Northwest based?
Well, I'd really rather stay in the bioregion, but things come in, and sometimes they're personal. Like, I'm working with some folks from the Community Built Association, which is a national network, and I'm working in Rhode Island on a kind of a campus, this really wonderful campus of art activists. It's basically community artists, and we're renovating an old building, and we're doing master planning for all these kind of the ways that all these different buildings where different things are happening, like lots of welding, artists in residence spaces, a whole network of buildings and the spaces and uses in between them, and then this all this housing that's being built around them, and how we're going to relate to all this new housing. So that's a pretty complicated project. And then I'm helping a bunch of people in Texas who have reached out. We have this wonderful video out that's hit about 1.5 million views. And so we're getting lots of inquiries, especially interestingly from Texas. I don't want to make anyone from Texas feel bad, but this woman said, we are in a really tough place here. Can you help out? And so we're doing some design work, some illustrations, some visioning work to support them, because they want to create really human landscapes where people can get together and have a thriving experience and not just be living these vast tracts of placelessness like they have in Dallas, apparently.
I don't think it's just Dallas. A quick anecdote about that is my folks ended up moving to Austin, and I kid you not, on four corners at an intersection, there was a mattress store on each of the four corners and three Starbucks.
Goodness. Wow.
And you just, there's a lot of repair that needs to happen. And if I take anything away from this, that it's like, see opportunity and hope and joy and lean in.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Lean in. There's only personal growth and lots of new relationships to be found.
It's beautiful. Mark, it's been a pleasure. We're going to link all these things in our show notes and to the book that you mentioned. But thank you for coming on. And it, like I said, it's so fun to be able to actually put context to this of living next to an intersection where there was a big mural painted and people came out and did that, and stopping off at a little free library or sitting on a cob bench and just seeing the little touches all around the city, and then seeing those things just ripple out into the world and in other cities. Like what an incredible legacy to be able to leave in like large and very small ways.
I would say that one of the things I'm really hoping that everyone gets to enjoy in the future is a change in mindset. Instead of coming and imposing and projecting like an aesthetic judgment, to lean in, as you said, and learn what the story is, because you're looking at metaphors, you're looking at handprints of people in a process of growing and changing and finding their voice and finding their stride. And when you do it that way, your heart gets to be filled and you get to be delighted instead of disappointed, perhaps, or satisfied in a certain ordinary way. So that's, I think, one of the greatest personal effects of the better world that we're all, I would say everybody's really on. I like to think that everybody's ultimately on the same side. And the promise of a better world is aesthetic satisfaction and spiritual fulfillment. And that's what keeps me going all the time. I'm focused on that.
That's amazing. With that, we'll have to pick it up from there for round two in the future. If you want to follow our work at Latitude, you can follow us on Instagram at latitude.regenerative.re, and mine is at @IamNeilCollins. We inherently believe in the potential that comes from connecting value-aligned and purpose-driven people together in community. That's why I encourage you to join our mighty network and introduce yourself to the other people working across the globe to advance a more regenerative, resilient, and beautiful world. Here, we want to know what you're working on and what inspires you. Through this platform, you can attend live events, take courses provided by our podcast guest, and create connection with other people and businesses that share your same passion. To join, find the link in our show notes or visit our website at chooselatitude.com. If you'd like to support the show, please share it with your friends and be sure to follow us on your podcast app so that you always have the latest episode downloaded. Another way to support our regenerative field building is to leave us a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. Positive ratings help attract amazing guests, and they can be the deciding factor for someone else to tune in and listen. And who knows? Maybe this is the kind of motivation that it takes for them to finally decide to align their profession with their sustainable and regenerative values and become a positive force for good within their own community. This show was produced by myself and edited by Anthony Wallace and offered as a part of our work with Latitude Regenerative Real Estate.